Welcome to NFP, the Non-Fungible Podcast, with your host, Dee Klein. Hey, this is NFP, the Non-Fungible Podcast, with me, Dee Klein. Today's episode is brought to you by the Koi Network. Koi makes minting NFTs super easy and inexpensive. Just drag and drop your file using their NFT wallet, Finny, and Koi takes care of the rest. Minting costs as little as 1 cent, so you can create as many NFTs as you want. And when they're viewed by other people, you even earn Koi tokens that you can use to fund your next series. Check it out at koii.network. Ben Noble from howl.xyz. Welcome to NFP. I'm so glad that we could make time to talk. It's been great to catch up with you just before the show here even.
It's been years.
Feels like yeah. It. I think it's actually been a year, but.
I know. Well, it's in crypto years, which is like dog years on steroids. So
yeah, 70 years per 1 year. Yeah, let's
right,
say that.
Exactly. I'm well aged.
Yeah, I think the last time we actually saw each other in person, it was like at the Super Chief Gallery in LA, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like an accurate place for me to be.
Is that one of your stomping grounds?
It's where in the world is Carmen Sandiego right now. So like Texas for the moment, Indianapolis coming up soon. So
right. And Indianapolis, that's for VCon.
That's right. Yeah. I don't know other reasons for me to be in Indianapolis, and I apologize if you're from Indianapolis and you're listening. I just couldn't. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, you know, I don't often get invited. Like, it's always like L.A. or New York or Miami. Let's just see Indianapolis. You're like, I'm gonna go watch the Colts play.
I hear they got some good car racing there.
That's what I hear. Yeah. Charlotte does too, though. You know. And I don't get out to Charlotte all that much either, though that's like home for me.
Have you ever actually been to like a big like indie event or like a NASCAR event? I never have.
No, it seems like that would be a very exciting outing to have with a good group of people. I feel like you have to have some hype people, because if you're going to watch a car go around a track 500 times, there's got to be some like intermediary like breaks of I don't know. Do people just stare at the track the whole time? I'm not a big race
I don't
watcher
know.
Yet.
I've never been. Right? I mean, I can imagine that's why people get excited about crashes, because it's a break in the monotony.
I thought it was just like a super tailgate. Like it's basically 6 hours of tailgating, and then it's like, it's last lap. Everyone turn around and watch again.
Right. Well, I guess a lot of sports you could boil down to that. I mean, how exciting are they for the first, 98% of the game? And then if it's close at the end, that's when it's exciting, you know?
Yeah, I only watch the last of every sporting event. It's basically the red zone package.
I don't know. Something about NFL. I actually like the intro, like, you know, where they do the I've been waiting all day for Sunday night or stuff like that. I like that. You know, I like sitting down and watching the song and getting that kind of into the atmosphere of it. And I love that part of it. And then I actually kind of lose my attention kind of, you know, for the first half or so after that. And then I'll come back second half and pay more attention.
I'm here for the pageantry. That's what it is.
Up where I am in Canada here, we've got the Oilers playing against the, LA Kings, that's American. Actually, last game was in Los Angeles just yesterday, and the Oilers lost in overtime, sadly.
Oh, no.
But it's been a good series, very close.
Yeah, I haven't been following hockey in a while, for a while. I played most of my life, and then I stopped playing, and it just, like, broke my heart to watch other people play. So I stopped following. There was like the walkout or whatever, like the whole
years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Years and years ago. And that was kind of one of the time periods where I was just like, I lost interest for a bit because everybody from my team like went. So I get back every once in a while and watch the Flyers play.
Flyers. Interesting. Yeah, so you're down in Texas. Bullies. Why aren't you watching like Dallas?
Well, they're good. I was a big John LeClair fan, so okay. I liked the Broad Street Bullies.
Sure. Okay. That was part of your youth?
Yeah. I grew up with number 10 on my jersey. So.
Okay. So you must have been sad then when my Oilers crushed your Flyers in the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, of course. I have very fond
memories of that Stanley Cup playoff. I remember Ron Hextall just hating him.
We don't cry. We get even. So.
Did you, though? Have the Flyers won a Stanley Cup since then?
No, it's not about winning for the Flyers. It's about losing with style. They'll lose, but they took out a couple guys, right?
Like, true.
Yeah.
That's true. They were pretty
the Flyer mentality. Yeah. We'll hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, the Oilers are a pretty tough team now, too, though. I mean, they got some big guys on that team now. So.
Sports changed a lot. You can't be 120 pounds and play center anymore.
Nope. No, it's very rare. For sure. Anyway, let's talk about Howell. Howell.xyz. This is your baby. Where now, you along with, I mean, you founded this company, did you not? Along with a few other people?
Yeah.
I'm misremembering things. Yeah.
No, yeah. It's me, Ivan Perez, Annika Merman. And we may elevate some more leadership, so stay tuned on that. But it's an assembly of talent in a lot of ways, because we wanted to get out of the box of just being a PR shop, which was what it, you know, when I got to the space, that's what I was mostly doing was PR. We brought in marketing, but there was this need to be a creator in the space. And by that, I mean, to actually put applications and put intention into projects that I think are going to meaningfully move us forward, and not just work on the service side of fulfilling somebody else's vision, but simultaneously being able to set up really amazing networks and leverage those networks for, you know, the betterment of Web3.
Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like when you get sure. down to, you know, the concrete elements, what are you doing in regards to that?
Yeah. So I, in our little release and announcement, I talked about immersive marketing and PR, and that was the philosophy that guided how we hired and how we tried to staff initially. And that was people that really are involved in the everything from the DeFi trading to getting on the ground and playing with the NFTs and, you know, all the beautiful degen behavior that shapes the psychology of the markets. I found that it was very difficult to trust somebody to market or do PR or craft a story if they were doing so from an operational, this is just a job standpoint. If they weren't mm-hmm. really willing to step into the trenches and cross that battle line, it was an exercise in futility trying to get somebody who doesn't want to be educated on Web3 up to speed and then servicing accounts. So that was, you know, number one guiding philosophy. We're going to tell stories. We're going to tell amazing stories. We're going to craft content that resonates with people. And the best way to do that is to have staff that understands. The second component of this.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Sure.
This space, like I'm not even, you know, in the PR side of things, and I get inundated with people constantly trying to say like, oh, hey, can I, you know, be on your show or whatever, that kind of stuff. How do you filter out the garbage? How do you filter out the noise? I mean, I couldn't even begin, like when I look at all those messages, I just end up ignoring them. And there's probably some genuine connections in there because it's just too much to filter it all out.
There's and this speaks to a lot of the concerns about gatekeeping, because there has got to be a little bit of gatekeeping from the standpoint of understanding that this was a very small organization. This was a very small ecosystem mm-hmm. that had this giant explosion of interest and right. invited a lot of people to parade as intellectuals, as thought leaders that have no idea what's going on and don't have the referential data of before times. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was being humble in the early days and really building my Rolodex of these are the people that have really pioneered the technology set, looking at who they move with and then looking at who surrounds themselves with whom. And then based on that, making those judgment calls. And then for the vetting process on when you're hiring, it was really kind of testing the boundaries of understanding and having a good bullshit meter. Some people, people that want to learn, and don't know it, that's fine. It's the people that are feigning like they know it.
Right.
And don't know it and are looking to angle in to make a quick buck. Those are the ones you have to sniff out.
And usually, you know, it's just a matter of time before you do notice, right?
That's right. You can't fake your knowledge in this space for too long before.
Reminds me, have you ever seen that show? It was a series called The IT Crowd. And it's this show based on this IT department in some corporate office building. Have you ever seen that?
No, but it sounds like my nightmare.
It's very corny. But, you know, basically what happens is this person gets hired as the head of its IT department, but she doesn't know shit about IT. She doesn't know anything about computers. Right. And, you know, it's
I feel just, like it's... I've lived that in Silicon Valley. I feel like that's like a lot of people like in San Francisco, like they get
you'd
the
relate
job
to it. You'd relate to it. Yeah.
You know,
it was
they
it,
fake
the show.
Your way.
Was, yeah, the show was made right around like the beginnings of Facebook, stuff like that, you know. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's called The IT Crowd. Up here in Canada, it's on Netflix. I don't know about it in the States.
So. Burying yourself in middle management is actually like a huge problem in the tech world. And it's something I call out quite a lot. There are people that can have 20-year careers and they'll be like, yeah, I'm a 20-year expert, and they haven't learned anything. They've just sat in like the middle, and you're like, how, like, you listen to them talking, like they literally got like ghosted through their career, and it's
right.
It's astounding.
Well, it's like the meme in the show, because these guys are IT guys. The meme in the show, you've probably heard this meme, is have you tried turning it off and on again?
Yeah.
And that originates from that show, because literally that's like they spend their day just telling people to do that. That's their IT support.
I'm gonna go
it works. That's the irony. It works. You're yeah. like, oh, good. It works. Thanks.
Well, the illustrious world of IT is probably going to transform quite a lot when we can have our chat GPT digital assistant turn it on and off again for us.
Yeah, that'll be something if it can actually, you know, go and unplug itself and replug itself in. That'd be impressive.
This guy switches to a generator, full sentient repair kit.
Did you see that AI thing where, I don't know the whole story, and forgive me if it's not accurate, where basically what someone did is they wanted AI to crack the CAPTCHA problem, where the AI couldn't... recognize, you know how it'll have a CAPTCHA that says like click all the photos that are crosswalks or click all the photos that are
a bot, right?
Well, yeah. Someone got an AI to crack the CAPTCHA, and this is how it did it. It actually contacted someone in like contact list. I don't know what contact list it was, and the CAPTCHA says to this person, hey, I'm having trouble with this CAPTCHA. I'm visually impaired and I'm using voice to text to message you. I need you to help me to crack this because I'm actually unable to see it. So can you just do this for me? And the person believed it was a human. Wow. And cracked the CAPTCHA for the AI. Now, I don't know the full accuracy of that story, but I don't know. Google
I
it.
Hope that's Pretty real. Amazing. That's some ninja level deception coming from the AI there. So
right. So then you think, I'm how far nervous. Away are we from having people really well impersonated that are contacting us?
Oh,
like
not
even
far
like
at
all the voice stuff is really good now, and
mm-hmm.
and Don't, call you up and not, say, hey, I got a problem. Can you send money to this? Whatever.
Well, and you know, there used to be, if somebody called you and they were pretending to be somebody else, you could always be like, all right, you know, flip on your video type thing. If it was somebody you knew. Now that even with the deep fake stuff, maybe that you'll look like you're talking to your mom and she's like, no, I really need you to send me $100. I'm in trouble. And you're right. Like, oh, okay.
It's yeah. You had a little, I always stalk people's tweets before I have them on the show. You had a little interaction with Tom Bilyeu where he was talking about AI and talking about AI children.
Yeah, Tom goes super into the weeds with it, and that's why I love listening to him speak and things like that, is because he really has been obsessive about this type of technology for quite some time. Even to the point where his own brand and some of the projects he's working on, like he has components of artificial intelligence, I'm sure he's looking to incorporate. And he's definitely in the category of not afraid of the future. He's probably an ultra bull on what's coming down the pipe. But
what do you think it does to the creator industry longer term?
It becomes a tool set. I think it's really difficult when we see new technologies arise to say, this is where I fit in that world. If you were even to tell your kids 20 years ago what the job market would look like in terms of the technology world, you'd probably be incredibly wrong. Like some of the new jobs that have been created have literally been created in the past few decades and were around technologies that at the time hadn't even been conceptualized. So I think when we talk about creation, creation is a subjective process, right? Like you can step into something and you can redefine worlds and create beauty in the way that you see it. And so if artificial intelligence is going to create an interpretation of beauty, it's not going to be the single mold of beauty and interest. It's going to be a generalization of inputs. And so I don't think it casts artists out. I think it makes them work in a different capacity.
Quick update here on what's going on at the Koi Network. Koi's new task templates are live and ready to use. These templates streamline and advance Web3 development by standardizing dApp design. They only take 5 minutes to deploy, and it's all in JavaScript. Task templates catapult Koi into the $480 billion cloud computing market, competing with services like Heroku, Vercel, and AWS Lambda to offer the same services at a fraction of the cost. Unlike those options, though, Koi delivers superior security and is more resistant to malicious attacks because of thousands of nodes in their network. With over 1,000 downloads in the last 2 months, projects are already embracing Koi's task template. You can learn to create your own task by heading to the latest blog on their website, blog.koi.network. That's blog.koii.network. See, my feeling is at the end of the day, people will still want stuff that's been touched by human hands, that's been created by a person. There's going to be that connection people desire, I feel.
I could concur on that. Yeah, I think there's always going to be, the pendulum swings this way quite a lot. So we had our hipster movement a while back, and I feel like it's coming to that, where you go, everyone's super digital, super futuristic, and then it's like, we like records.
Vinyl
again.
Records.
And yeah, yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised to see those pull and counterpulls and like culture as we try to like say, okay, this is what we want and this is what we don't want. We feel this is invasive and we feel this is natural, right?
You know, it brings up an interesting point, because I was going to ask you about, you know, trends in NFT land. And one of them that I feel is coming is a return to physical art, you know, and obviously we have that to some extent all along, but I feel like that'll be more pronounced. People wanting actual hands-on stuff that maybe it's tokenized, but
it seems like
it's been always kind of a relatively small segment of the market, but I feel like it'll be bigger.
And Anico leads our talent management division, so we have a good roster of artists on board. And I would say we have some that have historically done a lot in the traditional art world that we are now trying to get into this Web3 environment. And then there are other people that may be Web3 known, but are not known by the old traditional guard. And there's that chasm of interest. And it's interesting because we are having to play at both sides right now. Totally. And I've got a guy on the roster that has been in the MoMA. Like he's incredible. Like he's one of the most lived individuals. And every time I talk to him, he has all these amazing stories. Like he's worked with Bob Marley, Basquiat, all this stuff. And I'm like, in the Web3 world, he doesn't have a presence yet.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, well, you just haven't shown up in the way that Web3 would go, aha, I've seen him. And then you have like 18-year-olds like Fuocious that came out of nowhere and are just like splattered on CNN and everywhere, and the piece is going for millions of dollars. So I think it's very bohemian, honestly. Like there's this explosion of interest, and it's very experimental, and it does still feel very raw to me. I don't know if it's going to be, oh, everyone's going to pivot back to physical prints as much as it'll be, well, the physical real estate, the idea of having a painting will come with digital receipts that do a better provenance tracking.
Exactly. So, yeah, I agree. I see that that being where it moves towards is, you know, let's look at how, what are the greatest strengths of this technology, and let's use that, you know, because to me, the digital art NFTs obviously were, and I've said this many times, I think they were the first killer app really for blockchain technology in terms of Ethereum, at least, you know, and now it has to be refined. It has to be developed. We've gotten beyond, you know, the rudimentary, you know, it's like when a movie was new. Well, I mean, it was called a movie because it was the first time you could see something moving. And it didn't matter what the content was. People just wanted to see stuff moving around on a screen. And there wasn't an element of, oh, let's make a good story out of this. Or let's, you know, if you've seen like early, early, early film, it's very mundane stuff. But it's like, oh, look, that person's watering their garden. Whoa. I can see it in motion, right?
It's like, listen, light came in into a lens and got captured on a film strip. That's magic. Like, really, when you think about it, if you were able to create that by yourself at home, you would be like, I'm a magician.
Yes.
Like, just because somebody else did the blueprints and the hard lifting. That's every time I try to, you know, thinking conceptually about how a computer works and how we're able to see each other and stuff. And it's like, you know, it's electricity going through electric coils.
It is remarkable.
Dots that node light up.
And that, but what my point is, that was enough to be amazed by. It didn't matter what content was conveyed via the media, right?
Right.
Whereas now, you know, we're beyond that, right? So I feel like the same thing's going to happen in this space. Also, the our focus on the technicalities of it. The reality is, most people don't care about that. They just want something that works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think we're still in a value broker system right now too, where there's still more posturing to predict what is going to be cool to profit off of it, as opposed to creating what is cool or inspired, and just because you want to create something that's cool and inspired. There are people doing that, but. I would say those are the diamonds in the rough.
Mm-hmm. So like, I wanted to ask you about this, Ben. What specifically are you doing at Howl? What's your job there?
Who knows? Who knows? They haven't told me yet.
I figured you would say that.
No. So obviously, you know, I got my chops in doing public relations. I was doing that in the Web2 world, had a lot of success in my early life in doing that. And a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to break out of just that publicist mentality. I've done a lot of advisors. I've done protocol conceptualization. And we actually do have a labs team now, and we're working on product. And a lot of those products are things that I had as fever dreams that now I'm able to put into action. But my role in particular is going to be focused on the metaverse build outs, the Web3, it is taking me into more of a creator. How do I want to blaze trails, and in what categories do I want to blaze trails? So you'll see more coming from me. I actually have an NFT project that is unannounced that I will be looking
to. Any alpha
probably
you want to drop here?
Well, I may be debuting it in May. We've been working on it for over a year and a half. And we had a team of artists, we had the tech development side all running under the bull market going, should we release this? No, it's not done. I don't want to release anything where people have to wait 3 to 6 months to get value out of it. So I think when it does come out, people will be impressed, because it, for us, it was it's been very much a hurry up and wait process, but we're ready to show what we've been working on. So.
Very cool. Yeah. And, you know, I noticed you're big on the conference. That's a big part of your job too, right? Like being at all these conferences, connecting with people. Right. And I saw you've got tickets to VCon.
Right.
I was looking that up. I was looking that up on OpenSea. I was like, tickets to VCon, I wonder. And I couldn't believe they were such a bargain. They were like, I think the lowest, the floor price right now on OpenSea for a VCon ticket was like 0.9 ETH. So you're talking like 170 US.
Right. So the Outer Edge got us out there, and as media partners, we did like a podcasting stage. I do Twitter Spaces. That audience started growing. I do right two Twitter Spaces a week now, and I'm gonna continue doing that stuff. But becoming and stepping in that role of interviewers is fun as well, by the way. But through that, there became like this aha, we need to be a little bit more involved in the event circuit, because that's where you get a little bit more of the IRL face-to-face consulting with individuals. You get to break through this barrier of just a profile picture and then have real conversations with some of the people that are going to take the time to be physically present at an area that's catered to their interests. So obviously, if I want to find people that are interested in Web3, yeah, you know, I can go online and scour for people that are making comments about that. But when I'm in person at those type of arenas, I'm able to be like, oh, that's, you know, here's this person talking about this thing. And I'm not looking at their follower numbers or anything. I'm just actually listening to what they're saying and figuring out who's the next person I want to add to the Rolodex.
Right.
But yeah, you know, Outer Edge, and we got Consensus, and now then VCon after that. So it's just, you know, I did South by Southwest too. I'm in Austin. So it's just been like back to back to back to back.
No kidding. Yeah. And do you find like, is it energizing for you? Is it tiring for you? Like, there must be times where you're like, oh, I don't know if I feel like doing another conference shortly.
The answer is yes to both. It's both energizing and exhausting simultaneously. I burnt out bad actually at Outer Edge. I got sick for about a week afterwards. So.
Yeah, you had COVID, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my like second, third batch of it, whatever. Mm. And it, you know, that's despite having gotten the vaccine in the early things. It's like the new COVID, same as the old COVID, right?
But wait, there's more.
Right. Right, exactly. I got the sequel going for the
with
trilogy.
New features.
Utility. Wow.
Yeah.
So
keeps coming.
But those are great. Like and that's where like I'll meet a whole cohort of people, and then you get to see the synergies of several interesting human beings simultaneously. So I get to hang out with somebody who works in film and music and a visual artist. And then not just in the conference setting where I get to listen to them instruct and talk about their craft, but then afterwards in these little side parties and events where there's kind of this cheeky little back and forth as people banter about their areas of interest. I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, with Howl, you know, I'm guessing like sometimes as you're networking, you're meeting clients, you're meeting people that are, what's the, you know, this is something that you mentioned as a problem in the space, was that, you know, attention in and of itself is not really something that's scalable. There's a limited amount of attention as a resource out there. You know, how do you make that, like, what's the client experience like with Howl?
Yeah,
was that a convoluted question? Do you see what I'm driving at? What I'm
No. The difficulty of scaling attention is actually part of even the labs department and what I'm trying to work on. And it's this conversation that I have a lot with people trying to hit the attention of everyone simultaneously, and through doing so, watering down the conversation. And I think it's become more about identifying the true driving forces and not the macros of we have the best price and the highest transactions and all that stuff as a barometer for did we do something successful. I think when you're trying to inspire and you're trying to create inspired change, you have to find people that are true visionaries that are even willing to go against the grain in a lot of what they do. But in trying to grab attention, it's about getting to the root of real stories and saying something that's compelling. And stories don't hit everybody the same way. Some people like horror films, other people hate them, some people like thrillers, other people don't, you know, you can't skate around this, this industry of averages and think that that's going to make a dent in the world. You have to really go deep on something. So I've been looking a lot at people
basically
that are
pick your niche.
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking at people that are, you know, driving in the music world, but are also doing like sound innovations and are like getting really experimental with the genres. And we actually see that is materialized as success in the traditional world. People like Bad Bunny and Doja Cat, where every album feels radically different. Like they will change up the language they're singing in, or you know, Doja Cat, I think, was like, I'm going to go heavy metal this next album. And like, it's kind of that don't put me in a box, but then going into something that resonates with a very specific genre and going so deep that everyone's like, you know what? I do like this. I really do like this. I didn't think I would, but I like it. Yeah.
Mm. It reminds me of kind of the old argument. Well, it still comes up in the art spaces, like having like your brand, so to speak, having a recognizable style as an artist. And obviously that is important, but it's also important that you do like what you're saying, where you're kind of trying new things and developing. You know, it's a tricky balance.
Yeah, I sounds like I contradicted myself when I was talking about this, because I'm like, oh, you don't want to go too general. And then I talk about artists experimenting from different things. What I'm saying is you don't want to water it down by trying to create something that speaks to everybody simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem for a lot of clients and people that come through the door, whether they're creating an exchange. When they're creating they're creating an app, whatever. When you ask them about their identity, they're like, well, they don't know if they're trying to hit developers or consumers or artists or what caliber of artists. And so they try to do it all simultaneously, and it ends up failing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ambition almost gets away from them. So I started nailing in specifically now, while the market's low, you want to say, okay, but who are the key opinion leaders? And do they buy into what you're saying? So let's go get them.
So let's talk failure. I mean, you've been in Web3 since what year?
2017. Yeah.
Okay. So the same as me about, I was kind of digging into it around 2016, but didn't actually start doing stuff with it until 17.
Yeah. I think like 2017, and then I didn't start doing things until 2018. So
okay.
I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're ahead of me.
Yay, I win. Whatever.
The guy was like, nice. I've been in 2014.
Yeah. That's 2017 is, you know, a year a lot of people entered, because that's when Bitcoin went crazy. Yeah. Yes. But anyway, what I was asking you was, can you look back in time at a failure you experienced in that span of time, you know, running a business in this space, that you look back on and go, yeah, you know, in the end, that I learned from that, I gained from that?
Yeah, man, fail faster. I failed a lot. I failed a lot, and over and over and over again. And it didn't bother me that much, really, because I picked up and I kept going. I would look at what failure actually is. You don't really fail if you don't quit. But I would say that the failures were originally coming into the space. There was a lot of modeling and trying to model off of what I knew, which was more Web 2 oriented. And so it did take a while for it to hit that this was a different world. I was somebody who really liked picking. I hate not understanding things. So I would pick up the white paper. I read the Bitcoin white paper like 100 billion times. And I would read things like The Truth Machine, or, you know, other books at the time that were trying to explain the early concepts of blockchain.
Uh-huh.
And that was something that helped me move past those hurdles of, I tried something and it didn't resonate with people, and now I've got to recalibrate. And then really identifying, we talked about this, it's a slow curve. Once you get in, you can't just all of a sudden have this network of experts that you trust. there was a lot of people that snuck into my life that were disingenuous about what mm-hmm. they knew, what their intentions were, things like that. And so that was the other thing, is just kind of calling the individuals that were here for the wrong reasons faster. Yep. And yep. and if that was something I was going to, if I were to go back and talk to my old self, I'd be like, you know, if you think you're on guard, double that guard, and then right. add four more, you know?
Yeah. I think part of the nature of it, though, is there's a lot of experimentation and a lot of people that are just like, you know, let's try things. And if they break, fine, you know, learn from it. Like right. there's a part of that, too, where you can, you know, there might have been genuine, sincere efforts to try something that could have paid off or could have worked out.
Yeah, I threw a lot of ideas out there in 2019. This guy Danny from Vega Protocol, that he was one of their Solidity devs, and I remember he called me and he goes, "I did this cool thing." I was like, "What?" And he's like, "I split a CryptoKitty into 9 little shards," and this was the first time I'd heard about fractionalization. Uh-huh. And I don't even think there was the word for the time. I called them shards, and like, obviously sharding wasn't the proper terminology.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm on the phone with Danny and I'm like, how did this work? And I'm like, what about, like, are you able to do smart contract, like sub-governance? He's like, yeah, this is going to be game-changing stuff. And this is just in our off hours. I'm doing PR and this is a guy on another team that we represent. And this is just like weekend chattering things, and we were like, mm-hmm, oh, mm-hmm. it's going to do this and this and this. And you know, 2 years, 3 years later, that became manifest. But at the time, a lot of the ideas we proposed are funny to look back at, because we were like convinced that there was going to be some of the utility was going to be easy, and it was just like, oh yeah, we'll just be able to do this and
just use this sub-government JavaScript, yeah, whatever.
Not at all. Yeah, it was way harder. And it's and that's the other thing, if a dev tells you something takes 6 months, it's going to take a year. Like, again,
I've heard from a lot of devs who are like, oh yeah, that's easy, we could do that no problem, and it's like it never materializes. Like, so I guess it wasn't as easy as you imagined, was it?
That is the biggest problem in this space. Developers do not trust developers to give you a timeline ever. Everything I've been involved in, we've had to dilate the time frame by like double whatever.
And if they say it's easy, they haven't thought it through.
Right, exactly. You know, well, I mean, it works, but like it's super vulnerable and like it's going to drain everybody's wallets is not the answer.
That's like this European stable coin. Did you see this thing? They built a stable coin on Ethereum. It's just announced the other day. Okay.
No, I missed this.
But it needs gas fees for all the transactions. It's like, what kind of, who designed this?
For each dollar you pay, a dollar gets donated to.
And you gotta wait for it to resolve on the L1 blockchain. Like, what were they thinking?
That should be a meme commercial, which is like, in the arms of an angel, for just a dollar a day, for every dollar you submit, we'll take a dollar and give it to a poor node infrastructure provider.
Exactly. I know there were probably Ethereum what's it called, validators that were just like, yes, this is great. You know, obviously they're gonna have to, like, I can't understand why they launched it like that. I mean, I don't know what it means that it's launched. I was reading, again, this is another thing where I'm talking kind of out of my ass because I don't fully know the story, but I just remember reading this and being like, what kind of decision making was involved in this? It is kind of cool that they decided to build on Ethereum, though.
Is it? I mean, not like Ethereum's bad. It's just like, is it Ethereum, or is it one of the many layer twos that are out there now that are zero gas transaction? It's kind of weird to build on a mother chain at this point. And I love calling it a mother chain now. That was not common nomenclature nowadays.
Nice.
But there are other, I don't really care where people build, so to speak. I think building is a question of, is it going to be adopted, and is the friction of where people are versus where you want them to go so great that it defeats the purpose of building?
So I looked this up on Twitter. 0xFubar talks about it. It's this European stablecoin that they launched on ETH. Okay. He says, 0xFUBAR, it's the worst code they've ever seen. Every single ERC20 transfer has to be approved in a separate ETH transaction submitted by a centralized registrar.
Yeah.
What are they thinking?
If FUBAR is coming for your throat, like, you're probably wrong.
So it says they coded it so they have to whitelist all users, process all user transfers, and process your ERC20 approvals before they process your transfer from. LMAO is his response on Twitter. They may want to, you know, rethink that. I don't know.
Remember, the future is going to be built on Doge anyway, so why even bother?
You think they ought to, you know, look at some of the other stable coins and how they've been developed? I mean, a lot of that stuff is open source, as far as I know.
Nah.
Just copy-paste, you'd be better off.
Yeah. No, seriously. It's weird that people want to acquire the technical debt and try to build something from scratch when there's a lot of good frameworks out there. That's the other problem now. It's, we've gotten bigger. There's a lot of people that come and present ideas and they're like, oh, you know, I'm the only person, it's the best idea ever. And I'm never of that delusion. I'm like, right, somebody's, even if it's not out, if I'm thinking about something, I know somebody else is thinking about it too.
Sure.
And yep. So it becomes about resourcing. And mm-hmm. There's so many times that ego gets in the way of, well, I'm going to build it better versus looking at what the potential competition is doing out there and going, huh, actually, I never considered that. That's probably a better way of doing this. And then,
well, you, like, get married to your project, your all right? You get married to it and you feel like, okay, well, I got to kind of push through, even though there's other stuff out there that's actually got a better way of doing this.
Well, we had those fights with consensus on, like, if it was going to be delegated proof of stake, like Mimblewimble, whatever.
Mimblewimble, like, that brings back memories. Wow. There was a point in time I was going to mine Mimblewimble.
So people just think we're speaking Harry Potter jargon, which we are. So,
I think I ended up mining Ravencoin instead.
Oh, that was probably a better bet.
You know, I don't think it's worth a ton, honestly. I think it's a few hundred bucks what I am out mind.
It's probably worth more than the other Mimblewimble projects. So
I have no idea. I haven't heard from Mimblewimble in some time.
You're gonna have me going on CoinMarketCap now. Like, what happened?
You're checking Mimblewimble.
I'm like, where did Grin go?
See, I need a tech team that's on the side here during a show, like Joe Rogan, and be like, hey, look up. Yeah. What's the price of Mimblewimble on CoinMarketCap? Go look that up, right? Instead, it's, you know, you and me clacking away on the keyboards here, looking it up. So what's the status on Mimblewimble?
Well, Grin's down to, well, it's 6 cents, which is down from the all-time high of $14.90. So.
That's a significant fall.
what was the other one? There's
that's like, what, 99.99% fall? Wow.
It was Grin, and then I knew the guy who built the other one. I know his name. I just don't want to call him out right now. There was another one that was like, Grin was like the D-gen one, and then there was like, this is the corporate one. And I can't remember.
Okay, I don't remember. I remember thing about that was something where it used like numerous mining algorithms in order to prevent, you know, ASIC.
Magic. It used magic to do all the magical things. That's
yeah, funny. That was a different time. Wow. Let's get back on the NFT topic, though. I want to ask you, and maybe we can wrap up with this topic, is like, what are you excited about coming up here in the near future in NFT land? What are you seeing, trends or just things you're excited about?
Yeah. Can I give a little background on how, like, on the name, because it speaks to why the brand and why we're going in this direction. Definitely. And what I am passionate about. So the name Howl is actually based, it's not what everyone thinks it is. They're like, Howl, you know, Howl at the Moon, which originally I even thought when Ivan came into the room and he's like, we should call ourselves How. I was like, oh yeah, like wolves. And he's like, no. The Allen Ginsberg poem, How. And so Ivan and I sat and we looked through like beatnik culture in the 1950s and this whole idea of rejecting essential what society is trying to force feed down your throat and really thinking out of the box and taking the bars off of creativity. Like if you listen to old 1950s beatnik poems, like the Allen Ginsberg poem, How, it feels like a lot of nonsense at times. It's very mnemonic. The poetry is meant to evoke quite a lot. And so we saw a lot of what was happening in the Web3 and NFT spaces, people falling in line and following success as they saw it and not trying to unbottle their own creativity and think truly about how transformative technology can be. And not, it doesn't need to be in this rule set that's been predefined. So as we get into this next phase, what I'm really excited about is digging into this concept of storytelling and inviting people to challenge their mindset of what a metaverse is. I think we've been inundated with the Ready Player One imagery and this concept of like immersive VR, AR, but as a tool, metaverse is about consolidating and creating these bespoke and personalized experiences. And personalized experience means there's opportunity to create personalized worlds and personalized interests. And there's so much more depth in that. So I'm excited to be working in the creative capacity to storytell, to create applications that I think are going to illuminate and show a different pathway of doing some of these things, and that free us from this constant hamster wheel of boom and bust profitability, and instead start saying, how do we shape the world for the better? That's what, to me, should be the driving force of technology, is not just dollars and cents, but like, how can we do something differently in a better way, in a better capacity? And so I'm hoping that we inspire that through what we do. But yeah, you'll see Howl is going to have a lot of Allen Ginsberg references thematically as we go through things. I'll tell you guys, because I haven't officially announced it, but I'll give the name here because some people I've told the name is Rockland. And Rockland is something that is mentioned in the Allen Ginsberg poem. And that's all I'll say without Easter egging too much, but to me, history repeats itself too. And I see this as very much like another bohemian phase of creation. And so I'm excited to create like these expansive universes and partnerships and, you know, still talking with, you know, Oni Force and talking to the guys at Kaizen and looking at what Azuki is doing and having these conversations behind the scenes about like, okay, let's, you said PFPs are dead or like PFPs are dying. Like there's a reason, because we haven't shown more of what digital identity can be. And so when we start this path of digital identity, which nobody has seen the full picture on digital identity yet, that's going to be some world changing stuff.
So how do you keep yourself kind of on that path? I mean, we are constantly inundated with distractions. What do you do to kind of stay focused?
Man, that's such a great question. I think distraction is not always the enemy of productivity, because it can inspire. So I allow myself to get distracted from time to time, because things I think are unrelated to what I'm working on, oftentimes the universe throws out things and I'm like, oh, like weeks later, I'm like, oh, that actually works over here with this thing.
Right.
I think it's important to root myself into somewhat of a singular focus at times, where I say, what's the hardest thing to overcome here? It's not necessarily the art, but I think good story takes a long time. And I think novel technology requires you to step out of yourself and poke a lot of holes. So I would say I trust the people that know better than I do to come in and form some of these things, but I create very organized pathways and a dilated time frame. So we were talking about development, you know, working on something for a year and a half behind the scenes, and versus like putting it out right away and then saying, okay, what do I want to accomplish in a 5-year time frame, and then what tranches can I accomplish reasonably? So I don't try to overstack and be like, all right, I'm going to have a film, a video game, a metaverse, and all this stuff done in the next year. That's an unreasonable expectation for yourself, as well as something to articulate to the public. I'm like, but what's one really dope thing we can accomplish in this quarter? All right, let's get that done. And so that's a lot of what I do. I start with those very big macro goals and then just arrow point it down into the singular thing I know I can accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of distractions, like I said before, I stalked your Twitter feed and I came across this one that I thought was pretty wild. It's this Eloy J. Kano, or Kano, I think. And it's him playing techno music, but without a computer. And it's all done with just like tools, like a leaf blower and a garbage can, and you know, and it sounds like techno music.
Hipster techno is it's hipster techno, right? We were talking about like going back to vinyl. I want to go see this version of Stomp.
Right.
It's fantastic. I don't know, I just stumbled upon it while I was like, you know, on Twitter for way too long scrolling through other people's feeds. And human creativity is just exceptional. It's washer pressure, or like what do they call that, a pressure,
oh yeah, you're right, it's a pressure washer, yeah, not a
pressure
leaf
washer, not only, yeah, it's a pressure washer, a trash can, a megaphone, yes. And I don't know what else he has, but
he's got like would it be a mandolin or something, or I don't know what it is,
but it sounds exactly like a techno song.
It sounds electronic. I even questioned, like, is it actually electronic and this is just fake? Like,
if that was the truth, like that pairing, that audio visual pairing is perfect. There's so much about that.
It's entirely possible that it was actually done on a computer, in my opinion.
Could be. But even still, I would be like, all right, that is what a pressure washer would sound like in a trash can.
Which would make it more impressive if it is actually genuine acoustic stuff.
It's actually, they're not even real people. It's all AI.
Right, probably.
It was all rendered on Unreal Engine 5, so there's no telling.
All right, last question. Two words, Twitter blue. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I see something there that I think a lot of people don't see. I see potential. I see a lot of potential. I'm probably going to give a little bit too much more alpha here, but there's something interesting about Twitter's API's ability, specifically in Twitter Blue, to read what is in your MetaMask wallet or your Ledger and then field a truth hexagon over top of a PFP. And a lot of people were very quick to jump out of that. I'm looking at that technology and I'm seeing a lot of opportunity to create defined parameters for rewarding individuals based on their behaviors. Twitter Blue by itself, when it came out as like a canned solution, I don't think there was anything that we were all clamoring for that we couldn't get. Okay, you got an edit button.
My favorite thing's the edit button. I've said it before. Right. I like that. I'll pay $8 a month to be able to edit my tweets.
and that's fine for some, and there's other things that, but like people looked at the verification badge as if it was a testament to the validity of celebrity voice and other things. Yep. And the reality is I agree and I concur with a lot of what he's doing by forcing everybody into this model, because you're not a better, more informed person because you hold a specific position. And the verifications were not distributed in a way that wasn't hard to game. At the time, the easiest way to get a blue check mark if you were not verified was to go create a freelance article, run it into any publication, and it didn't even have to be a highly reputable publication. And then you could have submitted it to the Twitter verification committee. And yep. Almost everybody I talked to said that was how they went about getting their blue check mark. And I was like, if that's the case, it's not like they were going, oh, this is a New York Times reporter and we're getting. So it was already muddied water. And so now if that Twitter blue becomes a part of a greater push to give things like access to trading tools, reward systems, right. Yeah. and creates something different. And that's the problem. Everyone's trying to think of the blue check mark as what it was, not what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
There's potential there.
No, I agree. I think, you know, the game for Twitter is to go beyond what it is now and to make it a bigger source of entertainment, a bigger source of interaction. And I think his goal is to, yeah, broaden it. So I totally hear what you're saying. I mean, obviously it doesn't get rid of the impersonation problem, but it does at scale in some ways, because you can't have like, you know, 1,000 bots all paying $8 a month for, you know, imitating somebody. Like, that's just not going to be practical for somebody to do that.
It was already being gamed. It was, you could go on the black market and buy a blue check mark and then change your photo to emulate somebody else. And so that as a defense mechanism, that wasn't working to begin with. So
I thought it was clever on his part to pay for the Twitter blue for like LeBron, Stephen King. I thought that's such a perfect troll to do that. He's like, it's okay, I'll take care of it for you. Don't worry about it. You don't need to pay.
I mean, it's a weird argument, and I love like people like, I'll never pay. Like, I don't care. Like, don't pay then. Like, no. Like,
I think what'll happen is in the future there'll be a feature that you get with it, and there will be people who go, oh, I'd like to use that feature. I'll pay for that. I mean, Twitter, I use that app probably more than just about any other app in my life.
Yeah, I've got mine. I've paid for it. And you know what I was secretly hoping is I got it right when the Hexagon came out. I didn't even care about all that. I was just like, NFT, like, I will support anybody who's in supporting Web3 right now. Okay. And so he had, like, Twitter Blue became a support system for Web3. Awesome. I'm in.
Yeah.
Even though I was, like, dumping money into a fire, I was like, what I was secretly hoping was they would read who had the Hexagon and timestamp that, and we would get a Twitter NFT airdrop at some point.
It's so, still possible.
Yeah, Elon, great idea.
Where just are my OpenSea that tokens? There. That's what I want. I want OpenSea tokens.
Oh yeah, so you can dump them and go get a car or something. Yeah.
airdrop. Legal, just wait those few hours for it to peak and get out.
You're in Canada, see, like in the United States, we're not supposed to be able to claim any of that stuff anyway. So, like the Blur airdrop,
whatever,
the Blur airdrop and all that. Like, there's like, there was a line. It's like everyone just goes and puts on a Tor router or whatever and like claims it regardless. But it was funny. They had that boilerplate. If you're in the United States, don't claim this.
Right. Yeah. It was the same thing with Binance and them, you know, saying, oh, yeah, you're not allowed to trade on that platform. And I mean,
we did our part. Don't do that.
Like, don't do it.
Yeah. Cool.
Use a VPN, they say. Yeah. Right on. Well, hey, thank you very much for spending this time chatting with me. I really appreciate you taking the time, and it was just great to catch up with you.
Yeah, hopefully I didn't bore everyone to tears, but this was fun.
Not at all. Right on. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Well, my pleasure.
Take care.
All right.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode of NFP with Decline, please like and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. Thanks again for listening to the Non-Fungible Podcast. See you again soon.